And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
I am David.
Grace is joining us straight after a couple hours over at Geek Girl Con.
What? Jealous. Are you?
Yes, I am actually. I really wanted to go. It didn't quite work out this year.
Yeah, but not an hour ago, I got to see the lovely Miss Denise Crosby there. I tell you, she's aged really well.
She certainly has. That was the impression I got when I saw her at Star Trek Las Vegas. And when you get back, you're going to do Craft Wars? Is that the big thing?
Yeah, Craft Wars. There's going to be a crafting competition where they provide all the supplies, split people into teams, and you are given a theme and make something crafty.
And both the personalities, I'm sure you guys know, Mary Swinsky, and Jarrah Hodge will be talking Star Trek at Geek Girl Con this year. So again, I'm sad I can't make
Sweet.
their conventions, but good luck to both of them.
Their topic is Star Trek as a feminist utopia, and I will certainly be checking it out today. I'll let you know how it goes.
Grace will give us a full report after action sort of thing. Okay, so I have a couple of short bookkeeping things to take care of before we get into our main topic today. The first is that if you would like to email us, our email address is allthingstrek@hotmail.com.
We love our emails.
We do love emails. I just realize that I very often forget to say that. So, new listeners might be like, how do I email? How does that work?
How do I get in touch with this wonderful show?
How does email?
How do we
And
email?
there is a tweeter, a what?
Oh, yes, and we also have a Twitter account. You can follow
For
us
the tweets.
at All Things Trek, on Twitter. And we have a Facebook page, which is where I've been posting most of the updates and, discussion questions and just random thoughts that I've had.
And humorously out of context photos.
Well, that too.
Yes.
That's kind of what Facebook is for, I think. Also, thank you all for the nominations for the podcast awards. We won't find out who's actually in like the voting brackets until I think November. But for everyone who nominated us, we very much appreciate it.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, before we get into the Wrath of Khan, because that's our main topic for today, I want to reiterate what I figured out about the motion picture last week, because I don't think I made it clear how big a deal this is to me. Because like, this is not something I'd thought
This
of.
was a life-changing epiphany for him, so.
It really was. Like, I had never realized this until we were in the middle of the podcast, which is that the reason I don't like the motion picture, like the core reason, is that the story is backwards. Because the story is supposed to be V'ger learning, learning human emotion to move beyond pure logic, and it's supposed to mirror Spock's story. Because at the beginning of the show, Spock, abandons all his emotions for some reason, and those are supposed to be parallel storylines. But V'ger is not a creature of pure logic. V'ger is a creature of pure passion. Nothing V'ger does is logical. It lashes out at anything that's in its way or even perceives that it's in its way. It can't comprehend the passage of time, and it doesn't understand anything that's happening, really. It's like a, and they keep referring to it as a child. How many children do you know of that are creatures of pure logic? Like, anybody?
Well, I did work with those kids with Asperger's, but
I mean, even then, that's not pure logic. That's just trouble interacting with people. And I mean, V'ger is basically a tiny child that someone has given a planet-destroying spaceship. And if that had been the story, if Spock had had to teach V'ger logic and that was what was going on, it would have been so good. We would have had the makings of a great film. But instead, we have this backwards story. So anyway, that was my epiphany of about the motion picture, and it completely changed how I look at that film. So, Grace,
I don't
David,
think you looked at it very well to begin with.
no, that's true, but that was part of the thing, right? Was that I really didn't like it, and I could never entirely figure out why.
And now you can articulate
Yeah,
that.
now I know. So, Grace, David, either of you have any further announcements before we get into the Wrath of Khan?
Not really.
Nope.
David, anything interesting going on with the Gates of Stovacor?
I disagree. Oh wait, wrong time for that. We're working on scripts, we're working on stuff, and so season three will be launching sometime soon, but like we do need to finish up some of the scripts, and then once we get a couple scripts ready, we'll start recording. And then there will be, some of you out there might know about this other audio drama, audio fiction called Star Trek Starfinder. There, We're going to be doing some crossovers between Gates of Stovacor and Starfinder, so that's going to be interesting. But a lot of it is just still, you know, on the drawing board, behind the scenes, in the workshop. But we'll let everybody know when the first episode is ready to launch.
And I actually just finished getting all the voice recordings for the next episode of Tales from the DMZ. So I'm gonna string that together. Grace is in it, so you know, you guys can listen for that.
So you know that's quality assurance right there.
And then last thing is that Star Trek Continues is still doing their Kickstarter. Give them money. They are well worth it.
All right. Kick their start. Start their kick.
Oh, one other quick thing is that Star Trek Renegades, I think, finished filming. There was some of the community people, some of our friends were on hand, you know, working on the sets, being extras. And then some of our people went to there for interviews. And so Renegades was a fun time for, you know, for set visits. And that's going to be hopefully put out soon. They finished filming from October, like 8th to the 18th or something like that. But they just wrapped up some shooting. And so that's got a lot of great Star Trek people in it, some community people involved. So keep an eye out for Star Trek Renegades.
All right. So it is now time to talk about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Electric Boogaloo.
Well, that too, right. But so this movie.
The real Khan.
This movie.
Let's not go there.
Is probably the most influential Star Trek film.
Pretty much, yeah.
Like, without a doubt, I think. I mean, there are other good Star Trek films. This isn't even necessarily my favorite, but it's definitely the most influential. You know, it came out after the motion picture in this time when people weren't sure if Star Trek could be made to work on the big screen. You know, the motion picture had been horrendously expensive. There were doubts about whether or not the movie franchise could even continue. And if we had lost the movie franchise, who knows if there would have been enough support for, you know, the next generation.
Yeah. Definitely.
So instead,
a lot of people feel that this is a return to Star Trek. A lot of people that I remember talking with in the past, you know, closer to when it was new and came out, and then in you know, more recent, that it motion picture felt more like a departure from what they were familiar with Trek. Where for this movie, it feels more like Star Trek, the TV show, and it even goes back to a sequel. You know, it goes back to an episode of the original series, which just, like, brings it back home.
Yeah, I mean, and it's hard to figure out what exactly was going on behind the scenes, but certain things that I've heard lead me to believe that the Star Trek show that we got was a combination of Gene Roddenberry's vision plus the talents and views of a lot of different people.
Yeah.
And then the motion picture was kind of just Gene Roddenberry. Like, you know,
yeah.
It's sort of like the Star Wars prequels, not as bad, but the Star Wars prequels are what happened when, you know,
you give George Lucas complete control.
It's like, this is
and
just
an unchecked ego.
This is just George Lucas and not George Lucas plus a bunch of other people.
Yeah.
So, you know, clearly this movie, one of the reasons I think fans love it so much is because this is a movie that I think embodies love of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the fact that the creative team behind the movie, some of them had never seen Star Trek before, and they went through and watched all the episodes before making this movie.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, how they decided on Space Seed to follow up on, which, you know, I think is a good one. There are a couple others they could have gone for, but I think, you know, obviously Space Seed worked out very well. I have no idea if they knew Ricardo Montalban was going to be available again when they made the movie. But, I mean, it could have been... Yeah, what was that, David?
Well, and another case, if you're going to pick an episode to, like, do a sequel to or to do the aftermath or the consequences, I think Space Seed is a great one to do it, but it also, on one hand, it's kind of like if you're going to look at, you know, Kirk versus blank, and you're going to go to the original series and go, who's his, like, nemesis, or who would he have a continuing beef with? I mean, there's kind of a limited, I mean, unless you're going to go with the Gorn or something. I mean, it seemed like Space Seed was just like a perfect choice on a lot of different levels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about the look of this movie, which, like everything else about this movie, or almost everything else about this movie, is really good.
Mm-hmm. And completely different from Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Yeah, not at all. But in a way, I think much closer to what it looked like in the series.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's a little bit more militaristic, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also much more colorful. Like, we complained in TNP how everything was gray.
Right, right.
Except for the inside of V'ger, which was a kaleidoscope. But, you know,
And while we do get that kind of dated color palette, like everything inside Enterprise looks kind of hospitally colored, like the blue walls and all that, it's still a change of pace.
Yeah. And like the bridge is just much more popping because it's, you know, you've got the bright lights on the control panels.
Right.
And just the displays look really cool. Like they look very technical, like the kind of thing you'd open up a tech manual and see that sort of diagrams.
So we get to see more parts of the ship actually, like, in action, like them preparing mm-hmm. to launch torpedoes,
oh,
or
yeah.
what have you.
I love that part.
Yeah.
I love anything that indicates that the ship is not just a bunch of people remote controlling it from the bridge.
Yeah. That there's actual work to be done manually.
Yeah, like when Chekhov presses the fire torpedoes button, what he's actually doing is sending a signal down to the torpedo crew.
Lift up the weird gates things and put the thing in the thing and...
And I think this might be the first time we ever got to see a photon torpedo up close.
I think so, yeah.
Like, when it wasn't actually being fired, right?
Yeah.
And it was kind of neat looking. I mean, you know, and that was the look they used for the rest of the series.
Right.
And, of course, there's also the uniforms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think are probably my favorite uniforms that, you know, I mean, I like most Star Trek uniforms, but those ones, like the Wrath of Khan through Star Trek VI era, are probably my favorite.
Yeah.
And even though they aren't...
Well, and that...
Yeah.
And that's probably the uniform that we see probably the most often, like the most used over time. Because there was the Next Generation that they had 7 seasons, but then as soon as they get to the movies, they change it. DS9 changed their uniform. So I don't know, like I haven't checked for, you know, production, you know, TV episodes versus movies. But we did get that uniform for a long stretch in the TOS movies. And among the fans, there's fans that go to conventions, like wear all kinds of different uniforms. We even see new JJ Universe uniforms at the Vegas and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a group, one of the biggest, most popular uniforms is the Wrath of Khan style uniform. And there's a group that assemble. And in Vegas, we had like, you know, what was it, 20, 25, 30 people all in the maroon Wrath of Khan uniform, and they go by the name the Monster Maroon because everybody is in those uniforms.
Yeah.
And an interesting thing is you see that, like, you know, Kirk and Spock and everybody are in that type of the main uniform where it's got the flap that folds down.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the part of the storyline of the Wrath of Khan is that, you know, it's a lot of cadets that were not prepared and not ready, but they had to rush into the mission. The cadet uniforms are the ones that are still maroon, but they have like a beige or like a piece up at the top, like by the shoulders and the neck area. But the whole maroon part of that uniform, I remember reading that those were reused, dyed uniforms from the motion picture, that because they had a smaller budget and they spent so much on all those gray and beige and whatever uniforms for the motion picture, they dyed those all maroon for the cadets and then just put the, you know, the tan or the beige piece up at the top. But if you look real close, you know how the motion picture uniforms were mostly like gray on the outside, but they had that panel in the middle that kind of was like an hourglassy kind of shape, and that was a different color. If you look close at the cadet uniforms, you could still see that seam of that shape,
yeah.
But they're all just maroon. So, but yeah, I love those uniforms.
Well, that's one of your hardships of being a cadet, is you have to wear the TMP uniform.
Yeah, but when you're a higher ranking in Starfleet, you have to wear that turtleneck thing. That can't be comfortable.
Nobody likes the turtleneck, although I do love the bomber jacket.
The bomber jackets are pretty sweet,
I
gotta say.
I love the giant, like... the giant frill collar that they've got going on for those things are so cool looking.
Well, and, yeah, so they can all, you know, reenact their favorite scenes from Top Gun.
Yeah, and I will
danger zone.
I'm going to acknowledge the chat room here, and they're pointing out that although the uniforms from the Wrath of Khan look really cool, they could be impractical because they have so many things coming off of
yeah.
them. They could be grabbed in a fight, or they could catch on something. And
they look like way more like a formal uniform.
Yeah, and
like a dress uniform. Then will probably be, you know.
Yeah, and I'll admit that, but I just really like the way they look.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, I also like them because they look like they have room for pockets.
Pockets are always good.
Which is something that Star Trek really, I feel, needs more of, is more pockets.
Yeah.
And then of course, outside of the character visuals, there's the ship itself,
mm-hmm.
which still looks great. And granted, they got to reuse a lot of that stuff mm-hmm. from the motion picture.
Yeah.
So, you know, as much as whatever I say about the motion picture, if they hadn't spent all that money, we wouldn't have gotten the really cool models that we got for the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And, you know, they reused regular one. They just flipped it up. Now it's upside down. Which I have to say, it looks better, I think.
Yeah.
It looks more natural with the sort of the umbrella mushroom thing facing upward. So, you know, I'll give it that. And, like, watching it now, if I watch that movie and compared to, like, some of even the later films, like Nemesis even, I think the Wrath of Khan special effects have aged much better.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you know, it's a model of a ship shooting, you know, staggered lights at a model of another ship. It's mm-hmm. not fancy CGI or anything. I don't notice the seams. It just looks like two spaceships. Yeah. And, you know...
Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, in the original Star Wars, if you look at the TIE fighters, you see that little cutout edge around them, and you don't get any of that in the ship battle. But you mentioned CGI and the effects, and I wanted to bring up this real quick, that Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan is credited as being one of the first, if not the first, full CG scene when Kirk shows the Genesis demonstration video to Bones and Spock.
Yeah.
He does the eye retina scan, and that was CG, but then you have the whole sequence of the Genesis torpedo or device hitting the planet and the effect of it. That was done by, let me get the name right, it was done by the Lucasfilm Graphics Group, which later became evolved into ILM and Pixar.
Yeah.
The graphics group evolved into Pixar in 86, and then, you know, obviously we get part of that also being ILM, so... That was just very cool because a lot of people point to the young Sherlock Holmes as, you know, some of the first CG in film because of the stained glass window that drops down. But that was basically the first, what I would think of is the first time CG is mixed with live action. Whereas this Genesis demonstration video is just entirely CG. There's even like, if you look at the film, there's the screen where they're watching it, but on the sides, there's supposed to be like, you know, the panel with like buttons and knobs that would supposed to be in the real world. Like Kirk could touch those. Mm-hmm. Those were CG also. So it was just like everything on screen was just entirely CG for that time. So that's just like groundbreaking and, you know, innovative that ILM, Pixar, you know, people in the early days were working on The Wrath of Khan. And, you know, some trivia books will say that The Wrath of Khan is the first CG sequence in film history.
And it's all like, you know, Bob was talking about how he really liked the phasers. I also really, really like some of the not Star Trek effects.
Yeah.
Like the Khan's crew and their like sort of makeshift environment suits.
Yeah.
Like when he's peeling off the mask, if you listen, you can actually hear the sound of a seal breaking.
Yeah.
And I don't know whose idea it was to add that in, but it was a really nice touch.
The whole separate look that they have going for Khan and his crew also makes for such a great contrast with the very neat, the very polished look of Starfleet, and
mm-hmm.
they've got this whole makeshift thing going out that, oh, it looks so cool.
You know what also looks cool? It looks really cool when Khan picks up Chekhov by his please rough me up handle.
Yeah, the conveniently placed handle on his neck on the spacesuit.
Which, I mean, I guess
you kind of know from the second you see that thing, you're like, oh, someone's gonna knock him around with that. Sucks to be Chekhov.
And like, I can kind of understand why they have that handle, because that's a pretty bulky spacesuit, right?
Yeah, but that handle would only be really helpful if someone was helping you get into it, wouldn't it?
Maybe.
Or if you're carrying it like a suitcase.
It would make maybe more sense for it to be on the back.
Yeah.
You know, if nothing else, so that if you run into like a wild Khan, he can't just like pick it up and start throwing you around with it.
And yes, the chat room is correct. One of my favorite things about the look of Khan and his crew is Khan's gloves.
Oh, yeah.
They're so sexy and so sinister, and I love how the beading makes them look armor-like, and it's just kind of a costuming fangirl dream right there. When you know that they've got a detail like that done so well, it's just...
Khan's whole uniform, Khan's whole setup, outfit was awesome, but when he first does the reveal, right, when he still has that big helmet piece on, he's got like a big like, you know, cloth wrapped around the bottom half of his face.
Yeah.
He takes that off first, and then there's like this little veil that's connected to the visor that he takes off. If you look at that veil part, I don't even want to really know if it's the right word to call it a veil, but if you look at that piece, there's like little beading, there's like little, like, you know, stuff hanging off of it, like accentuate. So Khan was styling,
Something
even though they were marooned.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I also, and of course, there's the much talked about he only takes off one glove, which, I mean, you know, they never explained why, and I don't care. I thought it looked cool.
Maybe he's a Michael Jackson fan. Who knows?
Or, I mean, I always just assumed he got some kind of accident or some kind of injury that messed up his hand.
That seems more likely, yeah.
And it's not like it's, you know, it's not like it's there's any big plot point that hinges on it or anything. No. It's just kind of a cool effect that, you know, if you think about it, sure, there's an easy explanation for it.
So much of, I think, what makes the character of Khan and his crew in this movie cool is just there's a lot of stuff that you don't really know what's going on with them.
Yeah, there's definitely...
There's a lot left to the imagination.
Yeah, like it was pointed out by a different podcast I was listening to that they don't show Khan's crew taking over the Reliant.
No.
Which I think is fine. Like, we didn't really need to see that, right? Like, this movie is...
Better to rain in hell in style. That's yeah. true. Yeah.
Shout out to Make Tea Not War in the chat room.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's definitely a lot of not showing us what we don't need to see in this movie, which is, like, I mean, there's only so many ways.
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
And in this case, they had the captain. It's like another case where they see, okay, they're scanning for the planet. It has to be a completely dead moon, dead form. They can't have even a microbe on it. And then, oops, there's a thing on the scanner. There might be a life form. Let's send down our captain. You know, it's one of those type of things again. So it's the captain, Terrell. Paul Winfield, great actor, and Chekhov. So once they get the bug and the worm in the ear, they're all susceptible. You mean it could have just been that the captain beams back and says, you know, tells the crew, go to your quarters or who knows what. You know, they had the captain at their disposal.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which is one of the few things about the story that I don't absolutely love is that in retrospect, and this is an admittedly very minor point, but in retrospect, when they're saying we're having such a hard time finding a completely lifeless planet, like, just from what we know about astronomy and the and, you know, and what's going on in space right now, our galaxy is absolutely full of, you know, lifeless planets. Like,
yeah.
Our solar system has plenty of them. So, you know, there's definitely the idea that they would need to look really hard to find a lifeless planet is a little bit silly.
Yeah.
So I can only assume there's some other qualifications it needs to have that they didn't tell us. Like, it needs
we can
to,
only assume, I guess.
Like, maybe it needs to have an atmosphere.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and, like, clearly SETI Alpha 5 did have an atmosphere.
Maybe it needed to be in an unclaimed area or something. Maybe there were a bunch of uninhabited planets that were, you know, like, oh, this planet belongs to Romulus or something like that. We're not going to do anything with it, but it's ours.
Maybe there's people just sitting on a bunch of undeveloped real estate.
Exactly. You never know.
There's the real estate market in the 23rd century is just crazy. You don't want to get into that.
They got Ferengis just buying and selling planets.
Here's another thing I noticed that kind of was a plot hole to me that I didn't catch on, like, for, you know, all these times watching it in the past, and then only recently did I think about it, because we have the whole scene about, you know, oh, you didn't expect to find me here. You thought this was SETI Alpha 6, and this is SETI Alpha 5, right? So they got the planets mixed up because they were expecting different, you know, environment or whatever.
Well, also, didn't they say that SETI Alpha 6 exploded?
It exploded,
off the orbit of SETI Alpha 5, which changed the atmosphere and the environment, right?
Yes.
Right, exactly. So then, if they knew that, you know, at least it was SETI, the SETI star, which, you know, you would have SETI out, SETI 1, 2, 3, because those are the planets around the star.
How many SETIs are there?
At least 6.
I know, that's... now there's only 5. But so the Reliant is going towards that star, going towards the star system. They wouldn't have had a star chart showing that this is the star SETI Alpha, and it has 6 planets, and then all of a sudden they didn't take the time to scan and go, wait a minute, where's the one planet? The planet's missing.
They just saw a planet and they went for it, really?
Right, it's like, you know, the scanner, the person on the ship doing the scanners should be fired because they didn't take the time to scan how many planets were actually around that star.
Maybe they need a woman at the helm to stop and ask for directions.
It could also be like
that was awful.
Just a little bit, Chris. Just a little bit. It could be some kind of weird. It could be some kind of weird bureaucratic thing. Like right now, there's this very bizarre problem going on in our astronomy where we have all these planets we've discovered and we can't name them fast enough because the process for confirming a name for a new planet takes forever. So we just have this constantly piling up list of unnamed planets. So maybe it's something like that.
Just call one of them Bob.
Just call it Planet Bob. You know, emergency backup Earth.
Earth 0.0.
On that note, if we can skip ahead a minute, Grace, because you mentioned women. I was actually very happy to see so many women represented in Khan's crew.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
I think Khan's crew actually had better gender diversity than Starfleet.
They did, and they also had less... They had outfits that were equal levels of, you know, mismatched, but...
Yeah.
Cool and kind of provocative, but not like over the top sexy, like you'd expect with, you know, oh no, we're hot girls stranded in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was kind of cool. And they also, like, the guys looked like they'd, you know, gotten pretty roughed up. And I was also kind of distracted.
You mean they didn't make their girls wear mini skirts that barely covered?
Yeah, they made the girls look as roughed up as the guys, and I really appreciated that. But I kept thinking, there's this one woman who they have, like, at the helm, who kind of looks like a roughed up version of Kaylee Cuoco from The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, I buy it. And one thing I'll say for it is that, so, like, obviously they have their kind of ragtag clothes, right? If you fast forward ahead to Enterprise with the Augments episode, I feel like they're trying to duplicate that look. But in the Enterprise episode, it looks more like they had perfectly functioning outfits and someone came through with a pair of scissors and was like, I'm going to make cuts exactly where it will show off the parts of your body we know the audience wants to see.
And that, folks, is why you need to get picky with your costume staff.
It's true.
Yeah. Also, one last thing before we get too far off topic from Khan's crew. One of the funnest things to do while watching the movie a second time is to look at Khan's crew and ask yourself now which one of them are the off-duty Chippendales dancers. Because that was a thing.
Oh, really?
A bunch of Khan's male crewmen were Chippendales dancers.
Well, with bodies like that, I can't say I blame them.
Ricardo Montalban, he could have done it himself.
He could have.
Look at him!
And just for the record, that is his real chest.
Yeah,
I've looked this up.
He was a buff, beautiful dude.
A lot of people think it was fake.
We've had this debate before.
I choose to believe it was real.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, I've never asked him, but the internet
It looks
tells
like
me
he
it's...
waxed it and everything.
Probably.
Yeah. So it's a good thing they were marooned on a planet where they had a copious supply of body wax.
Hairspray,
considering how feathered everyone looks.
Look, that's probably one of the byproducts of the SETI eel, right? Like, if you just squeeze it,
it secretes hair gel and wax. So you just have to, like, rub it in your hair and then stand outside and the wind will blow it around. So,
yeah.
Perfect quaff.
I'd also kind of be interested to know what Khan meant exactly by City Alpha 6 exploded. Because as a rule, planets don't explode. It's sort of a...
Well, here's a theory that I have. When the Enterprise was, like, driving away, like, we've finished this, let's go home. By the way, let's inject some trash or something. Maybe they, like, released some waste or something that hit the planet wrong. I like to think that somehow the planet exploding was Kirk's fault.
Maybe. It's also, I mean, like, the most reasonable thing I can think of is that maybe there was some kind of super impact event, right?
Yeah.
Like, some kind of, you know, some kind of rogue planet sized asteroid that the Enterprise didn't see, like, careened into the system and, you know, and hit City Alpha 6 and that kind of, you know, that would happen. All right. So,
well, and then from Khan's perspective, or the people, you know, marooned on there, they wouldn't really know what happened. They would just see that planet over there and then boom, it explodes.
They don't have the equipment.
They wouldn't have had.
Yeah.
Although they are super geniuses, so maybe.
Maybe they built telescopes.
Yeah, they could have found a way. They could have made, like, one of those eclipse boxes.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe Khan's crew exploded it, and they just didn't want to tell Chekhov.
That was our fault, but we're so not telling you, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They were trying to send out signal flares, and they blew up a planet.
Oops. In retrospect, not the greatest idea. Okay, all right. So,
Like that theory. Can we stick with that theory?
Yeah, we'll stick with that. It was actually Khan's crew. They were just messing around. But
They got bored with some fireworks.
All right, so I want to talk about the new characters that are that are in this movie. They're not from the TV series, and so we've got some sort of side characters. I already talked about how it's kind of annoying that Mr. Beach, who is the third in command, is like, yeah, the captain and first officer aren't responding. Yeah, whatever. That's probably not a big deal.
Yeah, everything's fine, man. Let's get coffee.
Yeah, who knows? Sometimes they just like to turn their phones off. You never know.
Everyone on the bridge was getting coffee at once.
I really appreciate seeing Kyle again. That's cool.
Yeah.
Little nice little cameo.
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about Savick. Grace, how do you feel about Savick?
Savick is one of those characters where it feels more like it feels from the beginning like we're supposed to like her, but we don't really have much reason to. Like, we're seeing her doing her training thing and trying to be all gung-ho about it, but at the same time, I want to say this is either the performance or the script or whatever, they're trying to do her stoic and she just comes off as kind of flat.
Yeah.
And kind of uninteresting, aside from, you know, the fact that we're somehow supposed to like her, mm-hmm. find her interesting, but there's just not much to grasp onto.
Yeah, I kind of feel like Savick was, like, her role in this movie is a good introduction role.
Yeah.
Like, and she was going to be more important later, but then, like, Christy Alley didn't want to come back, and they didn't give her, we'll talk about this next week, but they didn't give her a whole lot to do in the next movie either, when she was played by Robin Curtis. And then
was embarrassing.
Yeah. And then they couldn't get her to come back, right? They couldn't get Robin Curtis to come back for Star Trek VI. So what should have been the end cap of Savick's storyline ended up being a completely different character.
Savick is just the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher role of this franchise. There's a new one in every movie.
Yeah.
It feels like they should have established, since, you know, they say in, like, the text and the script and all that, that she is supposed to be half Romulan, and that's why she has a level of emotion. That's why we see her crying during the funeral. But they don't actually say it, so if you didn't know that, you'd just be really confused.
Yeah, honestly, that didn't bother me
too much. Or think she's just a really crappy Vulcan.
That didn't bother me too much, honestly. I was always okay with the idea that Vulcans don't, like, they can sometimes show a little emotion, mm-hmm. like, because we know they have them, and it's, you know, especially younger Vulcans, I can mm-hmm. see being able to show a little bit. Mm-hmm. So that didn't bother me a huge amount. Mm-hmm. But it definitely, you know, it would have been nice if they'd really, if she's supposed to be half Romulan, I would have liked to have known that.
It would have been a nice thing to just drop in there.
Yeah, and that could have been an interesting way to build up her character further into the, further into the movie series.
Maybe they could have brought that up instead of that really awkward, oh, did you change your hair conversation?
Yeah, I don't entirely know what was up with, did you change your hair?
Like, are you flirting with her, Kirk, or are you just looking into cosmetology?
I mean, it kind of looked like she was flirting with him, which it seemed a little unusual.
Does Spock know about this?
You know, it just...
He has a thing for taking young Vulcan ladies under his wing, if you catch my drift.
Yeah, just a little bit. but, I mean, because that whole sequence is a little weird, right? Because she runs into the elevator in, like, a robe with her hair down and is like, hold the elevator for a minute.
Yeah.
And, like, granted, the conversation that they actually have is fine, but the setup makes me feel like she's coming on to him, which maybe is a little bit inappropriate.
I thought she was wearing, like, workout clothes or something. Maybe. They just looked, you know, robey because it's Star Trek.
That might have been what it was. I mean, we do know that from what we established...
At least she had pants on, right?
Last week we established that Kirk has, like, a miniskirt robe in his quarters. So, you know.
And that's where Zap Brannigan got his look.
All right.
Well, I also just took it as she was off duty, so she was just wearing, you know, whatever she was wearing. But then Bones comes in and goes... Did she change her hair? But I also looked at it like it, again, like over the years of watching it, I didn't really catch on to it. And it took, you know, time and time again to really catch on to it. It was supposed to be a protege character for Spock.
Yeah.
And so it was like, and so that would have, like you said, if it carried over to be Savick in six, that would have been the end cap of, you know, the whole history between her and Spock. And how that, you know, didn't go so well at the end, but I kind of appreciate the character somewhat.
Grace, go ahead.
Which would have worked out really good if they'd been able to keep it with one character and ideally one actress, but it just didn't work out. I don't think that at the beginning when they were starting with Savick for her arc, there's not really that much to do with her, except then we get to Undiscovered Country where it could be her and there's actually stuff going on, but I don't think anyone who had been her wanted to be her again, because they hadn't had anything to do previously.
For whatever reason, Christy Alley and Robin Curtis, neither of them were available, and there was some resistance to having Savick betray Spock.
Oh, are you a shipper too?
Well, I mean, how can you not be?
Hey-oh!
All right, but
Another layer I just thought of was if they did in the script or in the movie say she's half Romulan, that would have also given, more to the Spock mentoring her kind of role. It's like, embrace your Vulcan side. But that could have also been early foreshadowing of Spock doing the reunification efforts that we saw in The Next Generation. So that would have been an
Yeah.
interesting tie-in to that.
That really would have.
The storylines that could have been. But I want to talk about who I think is the shining star of the guest actors in this movie, and that is Carol Marcus.
Yeah, Carol Marcus is one of those characters that's likable in the way I think they wanted Savick to be.
Yeah, I mean, like, I really like Carol Marcus. I like her both for her performance and for I'm
B.B.
just
Besh.
Bebe Bech, I think is the actress's name. That's how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tremors.
And she did a great job with that role.
Yeah.
And I mean, I like her just A, because she is both like a mother and a scientist, which let's face it,
And you can believe her as both,
up until
unless
this
you ask.
point, Star Trek has not been super friendly to its female characters a lot of the time.
You know.
So it was really great to have that, right? Like, they could have very easily made the Genesis device primarily David's idea and
Yeah.
have his, his crazy mom, Kirk's ex-girlfriend, hanging around.
Also, so often you see it happen that when a female character is, what am I trying to say here? When a female character is proactive and is aggressive, a lot of people will just take that and say, well, she's being a bitch.
Yeah.
But she doesn't. She's not being a bitch. She's just being proactive and assertive. And that's a fine line to walk there that often gets crossed with a female character in that position. It really isn't something you have to worry about as much with a male character. And
Yeah.
so that's always, it always is really good to see that happen.
Yeah, and just the fact that she was, the scientific mind behind the Genesis device, and then her interactions with Kirk are really good.
Yeah.
And you can totally buy that they have this history that at the same time they cared for each other, but that they also could never be together.
Also that they kind of can't stand each other a little
Yeah.
bit.
It's the reason why Kirk isn't married with a son, right?
Yeah.
It's because even though they had this passion, there was also like, we can't be together. We can't be too close together for too long. It's not going to work.
Yeah.
So I think that she had a very strong performance, and I absolutely love that character. And to answer a question in the chat room, the reason Savick is referred to as Mr. Savick is a joke on the fact that she's a lieutenant and in old style Earth naval traditions, and I don't know if they still do it today, but in the ye olden days, when you became a lieutenant, that was when you started to be referred to as Mister.
Yeah.
And so it's a joke on that.
Not very funny one, but
Yeah, it's
okay.
kind of an obscure joke, but that's why it's there.
Yeah.
For a while, it made me think that Mister was just the official term for everyone in Starfleet, regardless of gender.
And then we get into Janeway's introduction and
Yeah, and then
marriage.
that happened.
Yeah.
And then,
Awkward.
like a few more things on the side characters is that I liked David in this movie. Like, David again, this much like Savick, this was a good
Well,
intro.
thank you.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah.
This was a good intro movie for David's character. Because he's there, he has his whole problem with Kirk.
Yeah.
They kind of get over it at the end,
He has a
and
majestic blonde Jerry curl.
he does have that. And he doesn't do a whole lot in the movie, so I this would have this is a good setup movie for him. And we'll talk about again why I was disappointed with his role in Star Trek 3 next week. But the fact that they didn't follow up on it, I think, is the major flaw. Like, Star Trek, Wrath of Khan set up this great character that they could have used, but because they didn't, he ends up feeling a little bit hollow. David, do you have any other opinions on David?
I did like the character and the actor, and I wanted to see more of it, especially at the way that the relationship between them, that we see develop over this movie. And I was hoping, that it would just get more of him as, because here's the thing, him and Carol, I liked seeing non-Starfleet scientists, like, working Federation scientists working on, civilian or whatever, non-Starfleet projects. And I always appreciated and liked that interplay between when David is saying, we have something here that could be perverted into a weapon. And that's always the thing between scientists and the military. And I always just, you know, his role in this movie I thought was like small, and but it was well done and important for what it was. And so I was always interested to see if they were going to carry on, you know, Kirk and Sun, like, you know, that how that would play out, because he wasn't in Starfleet. But then we see what happens later. But and then just a side note, that actor, the actor who played David, appears later in Star Trek The Next Generation. So that's always, you know, cool to see him come back.
Next Generation.
He was, I forget the name of it, but it was one where they were all, they felt that they were addicted to a drug that they needed.
The drug planet episode. I don't remember what it's called.
Planet drug.
But it's actually a pretty decent episode as far as first season episodes go.
Yeah.
Other than the whole drugs are bad MK speech that they give to Wesley, which doesn't make any sense in the context of the episode.
You'd think Wesley would know that, really.
Yeah.
You'd think.
Yeah, but I don't know. Wesley's a little too chipper sometimes. I kind of wonder what's going on there.
Ritalin. Tons of Ritalin.
So, and then the last major major guest star that I can think of is Terrell. And Terrell, I've forgotten the name of the actor. I know you just said it earlier, but, you know, great actor.
Paul Winfield.
Yeah, Paul Winfield. Paul. He gives a really great, really pained performance.
Yeah, great actor. I do, again, as sometimes I do wish he'd had a little bit more screen time. I don't know I don't know where they would have put it, because there's, like, you know, there's so little wasted time in this movie that I'm not sure where else he could have had screen time.
Well, personally, like I said, he gives a really good, really pained performance when he's sort of under the influence, and I would like to see more of that, but there really wasn't time.
Yeah, and I think for he used the time he had very well.
Yeah.
He was a cool guest captain. You know, it was nice to see, just from an inclusive standpoint, that you don't have to be white to be a Starfleet captain.
Yeah, that's always nice.
Which is something that Star Trek has been working on, and I'm glad that they, you know, we saw that.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, when he shoots himself with the phaser, that's a very powerful scene.
Yeah, you feel it.
And, you know, he has a very expressive face. Mm-hmm. So it all, you know, that character is really great.
All right.
So to give a, you know, to talk
and
about...
Just yeah. The one quick note on Paul Winfield, he was also the actor who played Darmok. Dathon in Darmok from Next Generation.
Yeah.
Picard and Dathon at Elodril. Okay.
Very nice.
Yeah.
All right. So talking about show characters, the canon characters, pretty much all of them got some cool stuff to do in this movie. I think
except for Sulu and Uhura. Yeah.
I was actually gonna say Sulu gets some cool lines, like some cool kind of, like, you know, some, like, some kind of jokey, sarcastic lines that if you listen for them.
Sulu gets a few Suluisms, but that's about it.
Uhura doesn't get really anything.
No.
Like, Uhura
she
gets,
just reacts to things.
There's only really two Uhura moments I remember in the movie, and one of them is when, you know, Kirk says galloping around the cosmos is a game for the young, and she says, well, what is that supposed to mean? It's like he's calling you old. And then when she's, like, hailing Regula One and Savick, like, cuts her off and is like, Uhura, stop yelling at us. And I was like, that seems unnecessary. But yeah, so Uhura didn't get a whole lot to do.
No.
And Sulu didn't get as much as I'd like.
Yeah.
But James Doohan, I think, is the unsung hero of this movie.
Definitely.
Like, did you see how much he's emoting in this movie? He is, like, he is running the gambit of emotions.
Yeah.
And it especially helps if you know.
Well, yeah, you might have just been starting to mention it. Just like Savick not really being told that she was half Romulan, it was in the script or in the plans that young ensign was a cousin, or I mean, like a nephew.
Yeah,
so that's really why Scotty would have, you know, been connected and emoting when that young character, you know, meets his fate.
Right, and that's in the director's cut, which is what I watched.
Yeah.
So that, okay, you know, cool. That scene makes a lot more sense when it's like, you know, when he gives you that little brief thing about how, you know, my sister's youngest.
Yeah.
And, you know, just listen to him.
He's the baby of the family, and Scotty has to hold him in his arms and have him die.
Right, and, I mean, just listen to him when he says that his nephew stayed at his post while the other trainees ran. And it's so heartbreaking. And even later, when Spock is inside the radiation chamber, and Scotty is the first one who realizes it. And he's, like, pounding on the glass, you know, shouting at him, but he knows he can't do anything.
Yeah.
And it's, like, James Doohan is an amazing actor, and he didn't get to show it all that often in TOS, but here he really did. He really got to shine in this role.
Aside from the fact that he has pretty good comedy chops,
right?
It's good to see him be dramatic and be allowed to do it well.
And if there was one thing that I wish they had done differently with him is that it's a little bit silly that he brought his dying nephew to the bridge.
He wanted to show off.
You know, instead of, I wish they could.
He wanted to say, Kirk, this is what I do for you, okay?
Like, I wish there was a way they could have made that scene happen in sickbay, because I don't think Scotty would be like, my nephew is really badly hurt, I'm going to take him to the bridge, and then to sickbay.
Well, and then there's that one insert, and then you could cut to that scene where he's just sitting in the turbo lift, waiting for it to go to the next floor, still carrying the, it's like, you know, deck two, deck three, deck four, and then he's just holding him.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
So, but, I mean, yeah, so that was part's a little odd. A little goofy. And then as for the other characters, I mean, so much has been said already about how Kirk and McCoy and Spock have such great interactions in this movie. When, you know, when McCoy comes to Kirk in his quarters and they talk about how they're both getting older.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, that scene, it encapsulates just how much this movie loves Star Trek.
Yeah.
I really get the feeling of these are the greats. Like, these are people that everybody in Starfleet knows who they are. They're getting older and they're not really sure what to do with themselves now.
Yeah.
So,
and that's kind of the part of the subplot or some of the theme going on, because early on, like you said, Kirk is like, you know, galloping around the galaxies for the young, and she's like, what? And then later, you know, when they're looking at the
how do you feel, Kirk? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And first, at one point, he's like, I feel old or whatever. But then at the end, he's like, I feel young. It's like, you know, it's more not just about like your chronological age and your body, but how do you look at life? How do you look at the world? Yeah. What are you doing with yourself? And I appreciated that note in the movie, even though it's all about Khan and revenge and action and cool stuff.
Oh, not all about it, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, movie is like such a perfect example of how you can have an intellectual film that isn't boring.
Yeah.
Like, this film is very intellectual. You know, every bit of it that has action in it is a result of very careful thought.
Yeah.
There's nothing in there that is just, we needed an explosion. But it's very exciting, mm-hmm. right? This isn't like the motion picture where it's like, they're just talking and talking and talking, you know, or other movies that are like that. This is, you know, everything about it is gripping. And, you know, maybe it's because Nicholas Meyer is a wizard. I don't know. but it is, you know, it all worked very well. And like Kirk and Spock and their little conversation that they have before Kirk takes command of the Enterprise, mm-hmm. when, you know, Spock is just so Spock-like in this movie.
He's at his Spockiest.
He really is. Like, if I had to pick a film that would be like, you know, what is your quintessential Spock? It would either be this movie or Star Trek VI. You know, they're both, he works so well in both of them. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know.
Well, here's the thing I noticed about Spock in these, especially in these two, in the two movies you just mentioned, but more so in the films as compared to the TV shows, we see that Spock is like meditating. It's not just relaxing, you know, strumming on his Vulcan harp or anything. He's like got candles. He's sitting down meditating. I don't think we saw that.
Yeah.
Right. And that could be especially after, you know, dealing with what he went through with the almost doing the Kolinar, and now he's like, you know, finding his center, so to speak, if you want. But then I just, you know, the introspective, the philosophical Spock was always my favorite. And I think, like you said, we see that the most in this one and six.
Yeah. And like, I mean, as it was pointed out in the chat room, the whole theme of Kirk getting older was something they tried to do in the motion picture. And they just did it so much better this time, partially because Kirk is older. Like, in the motion picture, Kirk's not that much older than he was when the series ended.
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, he is. And also, in this one, they did such a better job showing that Kirk might be a little bit out of touch with the situation when he is sort of like, you know, he's just extremely confident. He's like, yeah, we'll just, you know, march up to Reliant. They're not answering communications, but that's probably fine. I mean, you know, he's just very overconfident. Like, whatever happens, he can deal with it.
I'm Captain Kirk.
As opposed to in the motion, you know, in the motion picture, he's just taking stupid risks for no reason and doesn't know how his ship works. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's, you know, it's just a much better way of doing that story. And of course, Chekhov gets some cool moments in this movie, which is more than you can say for Chekhov most of the time.
Yeah.
He doesn't usually get a whole lot to do, but in this movie, he gets a good background role.
Yeah.
With, and, you know, hanging out with Captain Terrell really elevates the whole thing. I mean, we already talked about how we wish Sulu and Uhura had gotten a little bit more action.
And also, you know, Chekhov being like such the kid on the original series also added sort of gravitas to the whole Terrell's crew being in danger and everything, mm-hmm. that upped the ante, really.
Well, and here's another thing about Chekhov is like a good example or illustration of this. And I remember thinking when I was a young kid, I didn't like it. This what I'm you know what I'm thinking of or what I'm about to say about the this film and later is, I was thinking, why did they split everybody up? You know, I love Star Trek about everybody on the Enterprise, and then we go to the movies and Chekhov is over here, you know. Kirk is off being an admiral at behind a desk, and Spock. And then now, in retrospect, I like that because it just shows that, like, you know, life in Starfleet, people go where they're sent, like military, but also like people's lives take them in different directions.
Yeah.
But it's always nice to see, like, when a found family like reunites and comes back, and they're always there for each other. So I just appreciated that. But I remember thinking, why is Chekhov on this other ship with this other captain? Why isn't he on the Enterprise? But,
yeah.
You know.
When I was a tiny baby, that bothered me too.
Yeah.
But like
tiny baby.
But it's you know that's how it is, right? And it's kind of cool to see that Starfleet isn't a static organization, right? It's not you get one job and you're going to do that job forever.
Yeah.
It's you know it's a military slash scientific space exploration organization. They're going to move you around where you can do the best job.
Right.
So that whole thing was really cool. All right. So I think we should talk about the villains. Because, you know, they might be, there might be a certain, you know, a certain je ne sais quoi to these villains. or maybe it's not even that hard to name, but, you know, Khan. It's hard to talk about Khan because I feel like whatever I'm going to say, other people have already said it better. You know, obviously Ricardo
Montalban. It's freaking Khan.
It is.
Man.
Obviously Ricardo Montalban gives a great performance. You know, I really love his hair in this movie. It's just so crazy and out there. You know,
his hair is so angry.
It is. It's not like his hair in the it's not like his hair in Space Seed, which was very, you know, very close down and you know, very very styled. And obviously his hair in this movie was styled too, but it was styled to look crazy.
Look like he's kind of been under a pressure cooker for a while there.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, which makes sense since they've been struggling to survive. Yeah. And I love how he was wearing half a uniform. He had like half a uniform on one shoulder. He's just, you know, he's just kind of like, sure.
We don't even care anymore.
I imagine what happened there was that he put on the uniform and it was just too small and he like flexed and it just split down the middle and he was like, okay, whatever. I'll keep this half.
The incredible Khan.
Yeah. And
don't make him angry.
You know, I mean, you get his sense of anger and, you know, and rage against
Kirk.
He
gets some great monologues.
Yeah. Even to an extent, you get his, you know, to a certain extent, you get his feeling of betrayal by Kirk.
Yeah.
That he it's not even just that he's mad at Kirk, it's that he feels like he and Kirk had some kind of trust that Kirk broke. Which you can see where that came from. And it's not that you can agree with Khan, but you can see why he thinks the way he does. Mm-hmm. So overall
it was a quick line, but early on when I was young, I saw that there was layer to it where it's not just that, you know, I tried to take over your ship and you set me down, you know, maroon me or, you know, put me on this planet as punishment. But then that line where he says, like, Admiral Kirk never even bothered to come check on our progress.
Yeah.
It kind of almost felt like abandonment. You know, it's like being
also,
shoved to the side and forgotten.
Yeah. Like they felt like Kirk and Co. had felt like they'd done their duty and it wasn't their problem anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And so it all, you know, that worked really well. And I also really liked Joachim, I think is how you say his name.
Joachim?
Well, Khan pronounces it weird. Like, it, you know, the way it's spelled, I would think it would be Joaquin, but
yeah.
Khan doesn't pronounce it that way. Maybe that's because Khan's bad at pronouncing, but, you know, basically the Starbuck to Khan's Captain Ahab, right?
Yeah.
You know, that dynamic worked very well between them. And if I had one complaint about Khan's crew, it was that I wish more of them had talked.
Yeah, it would be
like,
nice to see more of that.
Watching the movie again, after this is probably like my sixth or seventh time seeing it, I'm starting to notice that it's a little weird that only Khan and his second-in-command have speaking lines.
Maybe the extras didn't speak English.
Well, I mean, part of that is how you keep your budget down, right?
Yeah.
So, like, they didn't pay them for speaking lines, but I kind of wish a few of them had maybe gotten a couple of, like, you know, three or four-word lines, just like status reports or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's my one complaint about the villains. But, you know, as it's being pointed out in the chat room, when Khan calls up Kirk and is like, I wanted you to know who beat you. That doesn't strike you as pointless villain monologuing. You understand why that was so important to Khan.
From Hell's heart, I stab at thee.
Right, and we all know that Khan could have destroyed the Enterprise in that sequence.
Yeah.
But we understand why he didn't do it. It's a strength of the movie rather than us going back and being like, well, why didn't he just destroy the Enterprise in that scene when he could have?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a... Like, you know, it's taking what in other movies could have been a weakness and turning it into a strength.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, yeah, like, a good to show that Khan's not just some, you know, crazy villain bent on destruction and
there's no,
you know, killing everybody
with him.
Right. And even in Ricardo Montalban's performances at times, because if you look at other villains, like, they get over the top or they yell or they'll speak in, you know, the menacing, you know, gravelly voice or whatever, whereas a lot of times some of the most sinister and, like, you know, chilling lines from Ricardo, it's basically a whisper.
Yeah.
And so that's almost like, you know, more ominous or more, you know, you're not creepy, but like threatening. It's like, oh man, don't mess, you know, he's about, you know, he's not just barking and thumping his chest and like, oh, I'm gonna kill everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's been pointed out before, but it bears repeating that in this movie, the main character and the antagonist never actually stand face to face with each other.
Which adds kind of to the appeal and this feel of, like the old time maritime epics, like the Horatio Hornblower, Aubrey and Martrin thing.
Yeah.
That a lot of the early Star Trek was influenced by, wasn't it?
Yeah, certainly. And they were...
It feels like a nautical adventure, kind of.
And they were very, you know...
Part of why I like this movie so much. It really stands on that.
Yeah, they were certainly, you know, they were ship captains, right? They weren't just two guys who were going to have a fist fight.
Yeah.
Oh, well, speaking of fist...
With ships there. Yeah.
Speaking of fist fights, with minor note, the fight that Kirk has with David, it's like the one fight in the whole movie, really. Yeah. It's a really good fight. Did you notice?
Yeah.
It's not, there's no, like, you know, kind of cheesy double hammer blows or, you know, or
Kirk Fu.
Or Kirk drop kicks. It's like a very well choreographed fight. It's very small. And, like, you know, Kirk uses, you know, conserves energy and, you know, uses, like, throws some elbows, which is something you don't see a lot of in TV fighting.
No.
So, you know, that's just that's a very minor note, but I thought it worked really well. I also really like the story that apparently Kirk, like, the, you know, in the sequence when they're throwing over the access code to use the, what's it called, the Reliance helm control to lower its shields, they're supposedly, the story on that is that to get Shatner to be reserved enough, the director just ran the scene over and over and over again until
Shatner was tired.
Yeah, he was just really tired. And then that was the take he used. I like that story. I don't know if it's true, but I've heard it a couple of times. So now a couple of final notes, because we're pretty much at the end of our new 1 hour format, and I think we can actually wrap this up in about an hour, unlike the motion picture.
Yay!
Just a couple of points about the plot. I really like the addition of the Genesis torpedo because it gave everything a bigger context. It was like, you know, it's not just a revenge story. It's like, because can you imagine what would happen if Khan was loose in the galaxy with a Genesis torpedo?
Right.
Like, that would be crazy.
Really added to the idea that this is bigger than just one crazy guy who's after Kirk and his crew.
Yeah.
This is about one crazy guy getting his hand on a massive weapon also.
Well, and the Genesis technology the device or torpedo, depending on your perspective, it carries on to the next film.
Yeah.
And I think that was a good thing to do, because it does show, like David said, or we've seen over and over again, about, you know, technology can be a tool or it could be a weapon, and it's just depending on whose hands is it in. But then also there's times where it's like, just because we can build a thing, maybe we shouldn't, because look at, it's gonna, the effect and the influence that it might have, because it's, Khan wanted to get his hands on it, the next movie, you know, the protagonist wants to get their hands on it, and it's just like, you know, is it worth it, you know?
Yeah.
It's just a very science versus, you know, military, and then creation versus destruction. It was just a very cool device, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, and, you know, it has a lot of moral implications to it. And also, just from a minor note, because they pull the whole "we're the only ship in the quadrant" trope again in this movie, but it actually kind of works, because they're off in, like, a really remote region of space where they're doing the whole Genesis testing. And the only thing about that that's a little suspect is that's awfully far to go for a cadet training cruise.
Yeah.
Maybe, I mean, maybe the cadets do it hardcore in Starfleet Academy. It's just like, yeah.
Only if Kirk is in charge.
Kirk is like, you know, normally we would just do like a trip around the solar system, but nah, we're going to go right out to the frontier.
Let me show you how it's done, kids.
Yeah.
Maybe those were the seniors and, you know, they didn't have too many freshmen.
That was their senior field trip.
Yeah.
So, their deadly senior field trip.
You know, that whole point worked together. And also, they used a lot of really, like, logical space tactics, mm-hmm. like, when it came down to it. Like, hiding behind the moon, you know, or the regular planetoid thing.
Yeah.
And going into the nebula. I do kind of wish they'd mentioned the nebula earlier.
Yeah.
Because that was one thing that was a little bit random. It was like, but there is the Mutara Nebula. I was like, there is? Wait a minute, hang on. Mm-hmm. Has that been there the whole time? So I kind of wish they'd brought that up a little bit earlier. But it still worked, and once they were actually in the nebula, it's this movie's kind of famous for using the Z-axis. They actually, like, sink the ship down a bit, yeah. which is, you know, something that most of the time Star Trek pretends that space is just a two-dimensional plane.
Well, in it, the battle in the Mutara Nebula is a very, like, demonstration or representation, like, you know, almost literally what a lot of people, like what you guys brought up earlier with the nautical thing, that it's a very much like a submarine movie or a submarine battle where it's like, you know, there's different levels and you can't see the person. It's like, you know, I just really enjoyed that sequence of the nebula.
Yeah. So that, I mean, and like the nebula, we already talked about how good the special effects still look with, you know, with the damage being done to the ship where it just looks like someone is dragging a match across the model.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just really cool. So I think that pretty much wraps it up, unless you guys had something more you wanted to say about it.
That's about it.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, this is a really good movie, and there's only so many ways we can say that. So I hope you guys enjoyed this. We certainly enjoyed it. I love watching Wrath of Khan. Yeah. I've actually put it on in the background a couple of times. Just I will listen to the Wrath of Khan radio drama because I don't really even have to look at the screen anymore. I can just hear what they're saying. So I think, David, if you will be so kind, we will end the show and David will play for us Data Logan's email about the Wrath of Khan. And you can listen to his thoughts as we tune ourselves out.
Direct from the database, it's Data Logan's data log.
One is my name. The other is not.
13 October 2013. A few random observations about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Giant papier-mâché ear. Khan's chest and his single glove. Awesome new red uniforms. The retinal scan. Kirk's exaggerated Khan scream. I love the new realistic and a bit militaristic details that Nicholas Meyer had added to the Star Trek universe. The little details on the uniforms, the torpedo bay, and how it works. And it's great that he's able to add these little details that it really enhance the movie for the moviegoer, while also not going too far in that direction, and not getting stuff into the movie that we really didn't need to know. Like, there's no reason to explain what exactly Spock is doing inside the reactor at the end of the movie. And there's no reason for us to really see how Khan and his men took over the Reliant. I love how the movie started with everyone's death scene right off the bat, really defying the expectations of the audience who had probably heard even before they went to the theater that Spock died in the movie. And so it puts the audience in a false sense of security. Oh, well, that must have been what that was about. And then they forget about it for the rest of the movie. Until it comes back at the end of the movie, of course, and it has a bigger impact on the audience because of that. Although it always bothered me that somehow Starfleet had technology that was able to have a clear glass wall that could stop all this radiation, and yet they couldn't have a suit that could stop all that radiation that somebody could wear into the place. I love the introduction of Savick. I really feel that her character is best in this movie, where she's young, spunky, the Vulcan with long hair, and half Romulan according to the script, and the direction, and the actors, and the lines that were filmed but were then cut from the movie. Plus, she looks like Kirstie Alley in her prime, and that doesn't hurt. I really like the little touches of the interesting relationship they put in the movie between Spock and Savick that was picked up on later in comic books, and most specifically in the novel The Pandora Principle, where it really explains where Savick comes from and her relationship with Spock. I also like the Peter Preston subplot, although the significance of it just ended up on the cutting room floor, the fact that this person was Scotty's nephew. I just really like that because it's so rare that we see the family members of these characters that we know and love. But when we do, it really means something, you know? Kirk's brother and nephew, Geordi's parents and sister, and of course all of Worf's brothers. The biological one, the adopted one, the Roostai one. I guess the biggest thing in the movie was how the movie treats Kirk as a real person with real flaws, who's, you know, going through this midlife crisis. But also it's sort of redefining his past, because it reveals the fact that he had a son that he knew about and who he wasn't with. It's a bit of a brave choice to redefine the Kirk character as a bit of a deadbeat dad. I mean, it was a choice that he and the mother made. But still, that means a lot to his character, the fact that he was so excited about going out there in space that he was willing to leave this family behind, that he had some feelings for anyway. Similar to the decision that Kirk made in The City on the Edge of Forever, where he chose his duty as a Starfleet officer above the people that he loved. In hindsight, it could also explain the stream of girlfriends that Kirk had in every port. Was he always trying to recapture that special relationship that he had with Carol? Or was he trying to forget it? That old wound? Was Carol Marcus the little blonde lab tech that Gary Mitchell sent Kirk's way? That Kirk almost married? Probably. This movie's just great. It deals with all kinds of powerful, important themes and ideas. Life, death, rebirth, youth, age, family, legacy, no-win scenarios, fate. How to weigh the desires of the individual against the needs of the many. And of course, it's got a great villain in Khan, Noonien Singh. He's larger than life, he's Shakespearean, although he is a bit one-sided, of course, with his obsession with Kirk. It's not surprising that this movie continues to make deep impacts in the Star Trek universe, even decades later. The recent film was trying to recapture a lot of the glory from this movie, and there's still novels coming out that relate to this movie. Clark Terrell, the captain of the Reliant in this movie, is in the Seeker series, in the Vanguard series that came before that. And there's a new book coming out next year that deals exclusively with this movie and what McCoy was doing during the movie. I don't know about you, but I can't wait to figure out why he was in such a hurry to get on that damn elevator. Data out.